Good morning, everybody. This is October 4th, 2021, 10-4, as in 10-4, good buddy. This is the ADK Homeroom Podcast. I am your host, Frank, coming to you from the heart of New York's Adirondack Mountains. We had rain hit the Adirondacks this weekend. We got wet on Saturday at youth community soccer. It's so good to see all the kids out there playing. It's great to have all the other communities coming around. You hear the kids cheering. You hear the kids laughing. You hear the parents screaming at the referees. All right, that part isn't too nice. You need to stop that, parents. These referees are high school volunteers, or in some cases, conscripted high school kids who are just out there trying to fulfill their slave labor community service guidelines put in place, or requirements, not guidelines, put in place by the school. And then we have parents from other towns complaining about them, heckling them. Not cool. Not cool. But it's great to play soccer in the rain, and then you're all dripping, you're soaking wet, you got that raindrop, the cold rain trickling down the back of your neck into your shirt. And you know what makes it all okay? You know what makes it great? Well, I mean, obviously you're out there with the kids and you're working and it's fun and everybody's learning and getting better. But what really makes it great is when you go over to that concession stand and they've got those apple cider donuts and the apple cider mugs. You could get it hot. You could get it cold. That is the stuff. That's what I'm talking about. Fall weekends with apple cider donuts and apple cider. Good stuff. Now, for today's podcast topic, we're going to have to do something about 10-4, right? We'll have to do a trucker quiz or something. So get your fluency ready for your trucks. We'll do that at the end here. But the main topic, this is something that I've been putting off, frankly, because feels bad, man. Hashtag feels bad, man. It's what your kids are learning in history class. It's bad. It's not what I would want kids to see. Even if I believed that what the history classes are covering is what should be covered, I would still feel bad about it because it is so completely one-sided that the average teenager who doesn't read on her own or who doesn't go out of class and look up, read the news on his own or watch any sort of current event, doesn't have parents at the dinner table, doesn't even have a dinner table, the average high schooler is not even going to have any idea that there is another side to all of these ideas, all of these topics that they are being introduced to. The idea of controversy, or the idea that you can have different takes on history, is mostly absent. I will say there's one exception to it. Basically, just one side is presented. Occasionally, the other side is presented. However, it's not presented with the tolerance that came to us with the Enlightenment. It is not presented analytically or objectively. It is presented with scorn, contempt, disdain, and it is made clear to the students that if you believe differently than what the prevalent, the prevailing curriculum is teaching you to believe, if you believe differently than that, then you are evil. You are bad. You're greedy. You are mean. You're petty. You lack generosity. Your soul is tiny and dark. That's what's being taught. Now, how do I know? Well, I'm not in the high school classrooms, but the TAs are, right? The teaching assistants go classroom to classroom, And the TAs are constantly telling me how bad it is. America is bad. West is bad. Complete disdain for free markets and capitalism. Basically, any socialist value is taken as a given and is taken as the only way to go. And if you don't support that, you're considered mean or backwards or perhaps even racist, right? And not all history teachers are like that. Certainly not in my high school and in my current school district. I would say overall probably about 75% though, 75%. For example, in the high school where I currently teach, the only textbook in the 11th graders that the 11th graders use is Howard Zinn's A People's History, right? A People's History of the United States. They don't use any other book. And you should read Michael Moynihan's excellent takedown of Zinn and his book on Reason.com. It's a few years old now, but it's accurate. I believe Zinn passed away about a decade ago. And the book, I don't think, has been significantly revised since then. One example, when you look at, say, the 1986 nightclub bombing in Berlin, Howard Zinn he flat out says there's no evidence. That's a quote, no evidence that Libya was behind this bombing. But in fact, that's completely wrong, right? There were multiple convictions in German courts based on evidence of Libyan collaboration in these bombings. Now, you could disagree with that evidence. You could say, well, that evidence doesn't really apply. But to say that there is no evidence, when in fact the evidence was strong enough to obtain multiple convictions in German courts, that's just not okay. You can't write that. It's just factually wrong. And that's how the book works. It's completely one-sided. That follows, because most history teachers use this book in college too, and they're told how great it is. And that book follows the general pattern that exists in our history curriculum or social studies curriculum these days. And they might have some flat out lies like the Libya thing, but for the most part, what they do is present one side and completely ignore the other side. So they're not lying per se, but by omitting much of the truth, they are giving the students a completely distorted view of history. People's History of the United States again and again and again lists only the evil, terrible acts committed by the United States government or some evil acts committed by people in the United States or some unfortunate, sad stories that happen in the United States. It doesn't list anything great done by the United States. Doesn't, I would say 10 to 1 it points out the horrible acts from Trail of Tears to the wars, it emphasizes all the evils of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, doesn't emphasize anything about ending the war, about saving millions of lives that would have been lost if the war continued conventionally. It talks about the evils of industrialization, never talks about the fact that now the poor had enough to eat, never talks about the fact that child mortality, now you don't have to worry about half of your kids dying. Only the bad side of industrialization, only the bad side of the capitalist healthcare, only the bad side of U.S. foreign policy. Never any of the successes. All right, but that's just one class, one school. Let's take a look at something that's not so anecdotal. I do think that people's history is used in a lot more classes besides ours, but I was giving you an example from ours. Let's look at something that applies to all of the high school classes across New York State, and of course is representative of other state tests too, all across the country, and that is the New York State Global History Regents Exam. This is an exam that all high school students in New York State must pass in order to get credit for their global history course. And they do need to have a certain number of Regents exams to graduate high school. And this exam here is always counted on to be one of those, because getting the answers right is really pretty easy. You just pick the ones that make, you know, the United States look bad and the West look bad. That's always going to be the answer. Well, I suppose I shouldn't say always, shouldn't say never. Even earlier I said never about Howard Zinn. Once in a while, Howard Zinn says something kind about the United States. Once in a while, the Global History New York State Regents exam might have an answer that's something positive about Western civilization or Enlightenment values, but not too often. Let's look at it. So we're just going to take the most recent one, right? This is the 2020 publicly released New York State Global History Regents examination. Let's just go through it question by question, shall we? I warn you, you need to put on your happy music. Maybe get some Bobby McFerrin playing for you, or, you know, put on those warm, fuzzy pink bunny slippers. Whatever's going to make you feel good, you need to do that. Get your cat in your lap. Get your poetry out. Maybe read some nice, happy Edna St. Vincent Millay. Maybe get some Ogden Nash. Maybe some Lear nonsense verse. Whatever's going to put a smile on your face. Take a minute. You're going to need it. All right, let's dig in. Questions 1 and 2. Well, these questions, they're maybe not so politically contentious. They're about the Sankin Kotai, which is the hostage system, right, during the Warring States period in Japan. So from 1600 to 1850 in Japan, what the emperor did is to maintain control over his daimyos, his warlords, basically. There were several hundred of these scattered throughout Japan. To maintain control over them, he made them live in the imperial palace for like every other year. And he took, while they weren't there, he took hostages from their family and they had to live there. So that if they didn't do what the emperor said, he could kill the hostages. Or if they were in his palace during that year, he could kill them. Or, you know, they would at least be inundated, indoctrinated into palace life and palace values, and they would be part of that palace tribe. Also, it cost them a lot of money to maintain things at the palace and at their home, so that limited their ability to act on their own at home too. So these questions might not seem, you know, all that politically bad, all that politically anti-West, anti-Enlightenment value, and they're not. However, they do sort of point out how moronic the question writers are, because listen to the setup for this question. It's explaining the Sankin Kotai, and it says that this was a system, and I quote, to ensure political control over the daimyo, who exercised virtually autonomous authority over his own state. What? How can you read that and not think this test, and this is question 1 and 2, how can you read that and not think, oh boy, this test is written by morons, right? Which is it? I'll read it again. Quote, to ensure political control over the daimyo, who exercised virtually autonomous authority. What? Which is it? Is the daimyo, is he autonomous? Does he have complete autonomous authority? Or is it that the emperor is ensuring political control over the daimyo? This makes no sense. How can you have a system in place that ensures control over the person, and yet in the next clause of your sentence, you say that person is autonomous? I don't know. But this is what your kids are dealing with. This is what they have to go through. It gets worse. Let's go on to questions 3 and 4. Remember, this is just the most recent one, right? I did not cherry pick this. I did not go through to find out the worst ones here. And I didn't cherry pick the questions either. I just started question 1 and 2 of the most recent one, and we're going straight through here. Next, questions 3 and 4. These questions are about how free trade with England led to, you guessed it, the horrors of the French Revolution. Yes. All right. So question 3, the correct answer to question 3 is, and I quote, efforts to stimulate industry in France through trade agreements led to unemployment. So industry leads to unemployment. No mention of the benefits of the cloth industry, that's what the question's about, or the savings people enjoy by being able to buy cheap cloth from modern England. Only mention of these inefficient, backwards cloth workers using old technology in France going out of losing their jobs, unemployment. That's the only benefit here, just the cost of trading with England. No mention of the benefits of trading with England. And then after that, it mentions that the French government subsidized the price of bread, doesn't even consider the wisdom of that action, just assumes that this was obviously a good idea to subsidize the price of bread, but then it goes on to say it wasn't enough and things spiraled out of control. Yeah, so there you go, questions 3 and 4 about how free trade is terrible and how it led to unemployment and the French Revolution. It doesn't get better. Let's go on to questions 5 and 6. Questions 5 and 6. Well, these are about how England exploited China under Queen Victoria. It's anti-Western, points out that England is pushing opium into China. And again, it follows that theme, the West is evil. It is spreading its evil everywhere. It's always bad. You never see the good side of things here. Obviously, pushing opium into China, not cool. Shouldn't have that. But to talk about the great, great, great modernization that began under Queen Victoria, No, none of the benefits. It's always, always the costs and always the terrible, bad side of things. All right, let's keep going. Question 7 and 8. Oh, ho, ho. Well, if you thought it was going to get better, you were wrong. I warned you, it doesn't get better. Question 7 and 8 are excerpts from the Communist Manifesto. That's right. They didn't even wait to get through 10 questions before they're quoting Marx and Engels. It's not even a good quote, right? It's some completely wrong economics. One quote here from the passage that they print on this test, quote, but the price of a commodity and also labor is equal to its cost of production. Price equals cost. Price and cost are the same thing. And I constantly encounter this, right? I constantly encounter people who think price and cost are the same thing. Here's one hint, they're different words. Oh, but that's right, in English class, we never do the fine distinctions between words anymore. In English class, we never do the distinctions between want and desire and yearn, right? We never do the distinction between should and ought. We never do fine distinctions in English class anymore. So then, why should we expect that price and cost are different? I mean, that's not even a fine distinction, though. Let's be honest. That's a huge distinction between price and cost. And they're just being given a passage here that says they're exactly the same thing. Top notch. Way to go, New York State Regents. Here's another quote from the passage reprinted here in this test. It says, as the repulsiveness of the work increases, the wage decreases. Right. So that's saying there's no extra pay for night shifts. There's no extra pay for hazard duty. The worse it gets, nobody ever has to get higher wages for that because things get worse. No, just the opposite. I don't know. And why do people believe this? Maybe because it makes people feel good. It gives them excuse to hate their employers. It gives them an excuse to ease their conscience. It's not their fault. They're just being exploited. Oh boy, I'll tell you, the libertarian movement, the freedom movement, the movement for civilization, it's going to have to offer something better. You have to go out there and you have to offer like a self-respect that is based on something real, because what is being offered on the other side is this complete abdication of responsibility. It's not your fault, so you can feel good about not doing any work. You can feel good about just being lazy, because if you were to do any work at all, that's just the system exploiting you. That's just the man exploiting you. And if you were to do that work, you're being evil because you're participating in the system. The other side needs to offer something that is real, needs to point out that when you actually do work, when you actually own property, when you actually improve the value of your property, you are building up something of value in the world, something. Some wealth in the world that is worthy of respect, including your own respect for yourself. And you can actually, make a home for yourself and stop your mind from running from itself and trying to avoid responsibility. Find the joy in responsibility and the satisfaction in responsibility rather than this empty, hollow, momentary, fleeting pleasure of not being responsible for something and being a victim. I guess I have to point out one more thing in this Marx and Engels passage that they reprinted on this test. It says that, I'm not making this up, it's quoted, it's a quote. In proportion as the use of machinery and division of labor increases, the burden of toil also increases. So that's saying machines make things harder for the toiling laborer. Machines, tools make things worse for the laborer. Right. Jennifer Lawrence, okay.gif. I guess dishwashers make things harder for dishwashers. And I guess farmers have tractors because they wanted to make things harder on themselves. It's unbelievable. How do people believe this stuff? It's nuts. Okay. Now, at this point, we're coming up on questions 9 and 10. Now it actually starts to get better. Here, they're actually. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. It doesn't get better. Not at all. All right, let's look. Questions 9 and 10. These are about the French and British mandates resulting from post-World War I, League of Nations, and it asks how this led to wars. It's in the Middle East, right? And the French and British mandate there. And it talks about how divisions on maps were terrible, which of course they were. And the overriding theme is that the West is evil. French and British interference lead to misery here. I'm certainly not saying that the Nakba or, of course, the League of Legends is good. It wasn't. It was horrible. Should not have happened. But there's plenty of things that the West has done. They never show up on this test. Again, so 9 and 10 about France and Britain being evil in the Middle East. Questions 11, 12, and 13 about how great Ataturk was. He's a liberator of women in these questions. He's a hero. He's a modernizer. He is absolutely fantastic. Nothing about him being in the army while the Armenian genocide was going on. Nothing about that. Oh gosh, no. Let's go on. Questions 14 and 15. Well, here you have Hitler and Stalin meeting each other in a political cartoon, and Hitler calls Stalin scum. And Stalin says, "Oh, are you the assassin of the worker that I've heard so much about?" Yeah, so this question just points out one of academia's great missions and very successful mission is to make everyone forget that the Nazis were socialists, right? It says so in the name of their political party. They were socialists. And this question here is deliberately casting Hitler as an enemy of the worker, teaching the kids to separate the idea of Hitler and socialism. Of course, that's foolish. Let's keep moving on here. Questions 16 and 17 about the horror of nuclear weapons. I mentioned this in Zinn's book earlier, also standard procedure for history curriculum these days. It describes Hiroshima, and then, of course, the question is, what did this lead to? Well, it doesn't say that Hiroshima led to the end of the war. It doesn't say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki, compared to the by far most likely alternative, saved millions of lives, or at least hundreds of thousands of lives. No, the correct answer to this question, what did the use of nuclear weapons in World War II lead to? Sure didn't lead to ending the war, according to this question. It led to the United States and the Soviet Union beginning a very long arms race. They didn't put the word very in there. U.S. and Soviet Union began a long arms race. Wow. So, you know, I guess that's true, but again, the same theme emerges. They're emphasizing the negatives, not at all pointing out the fact that it ended the war. Certainly not even approaching or investigating or exploring the idea that maybe since we have nuclear weapons now, that might be accounting for, as Steven Pinker points out, the lack of violence over the last 80 years, the declining violence as a percentage of the world's population. Maybe now that there are nuclear weapons out there, the leaders understand that they will be taken down also in a nuclear war, not just their riffraff cannon fodder people, but the leaders also are in danger, and maybe that is what is leading to this decline in violence. But that idea never comes up. Nope, only the fact that nuclear weapons led to something terrible like the long and costly arms race. Next, questions 18 and 19. Yeah, it's not any better. Same theme, British colonialism in India. How Britain's destroyed India, the West is bad. Let's keep moving on. Oh my gosh. Oh, questions 20 and 21. I love this. Okay, so it's about the Khmer Rouge. And, you know, it's about Cambodia and the atrocities that they committed there. But guess what? Guess what they don't say at all? I bet you can guess. It never once mentions the fact that the Khmer Rouge are communists, socialists, totally avoids their communism, their socialism, their Marxism, after going out of their way to put Marx in other places on the test, including, as I said, that passage they excerpted from the Communist Manifesto. Now we get to this atrocity question committed by these communist socialists. Doesn't mention at all that they are communists and socialists. But what do you expect? I think that we're making our point here. Again, I'm not cherry picking these questions in any way. I'm just taking the most recent New York State test in global history and just going through it question by question right from the start. So questions 22 and 23, I can't even make a joke. I can't even pretend it's going to get better, and it doesn't. It doesn't get better. That's my theme. It doesn't get better. Questions 22 and 23, what do you see? You see a political cartoon again. This one is a Trojan horse stuffed with the West's biggest companies, Microsoft, McDonald's, companies like that. And the Trojan horse is being led into China. And these peaceful people from China are on the Great Wall, the beautiful Great Wall. They do not suspect a thing. They certainly don't expect that the West is going to assault them, right? This is an allusion to, obviously, the Trojan War and the Achaeans, the Greeks assaulting the Trojans, sneaking into their city, using a lie, and getting into the city and then sacking the city, destroying it. Well, yeah, so that's how this political cartoon portrays the West, as assaulting, as attacking, as sneaking in, as lying, as saying that these things are going to be a gift, when in fact, really, they are a bloody attack. Okay, let's keep working. Let's keep going here. Questions 24 and 25. This is an account from a Mexican factory worker about how horrible the North American Free Trade Agreement is, how the U.S. is taking advantage of Mexico, how industry and factories exploit workers. Oh, let's just keep moving on. Oh my gosh. Questions 26 and 27. These show the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, as a teacher. Telling students, and the students are labeled as borrowing nations, and the lesson that the teacher, the IMF, is presenting to the borrowing nations has 3 points on the chalkboard. It says, 1, privatize, 2, cut spending, 3, open markets. Okay, the first question about this political cartoon says, what does the IMF represent? The correct answer is capitalism. You know, and that's pretty much it. This is the last set of multiple choice questions on the test. I think I've made my point. If you're holding up the IMF as your example of capitalism, you're wrong. I'm done here, right? This is a classic technique, a classic strategy, classic tactic by the left, by socialists, by progressives. They label their own system socialism, their own system progressivism. They label that capitalism. And then when it fails, they say, oh, look how evil capitalism is. We need more statism. We need more government control because capitalism isn't getting it done. Calling the International Monetary Fund capitalism is insane. The only reason you would do that is because you are trying to set up this straw man, this target that you can attack and blame for your own failures in this case, or at least someone's failure in general. So it's crazy. The IMF was founded by Keynes, for goodness sakes. Are you kidding me to call the IMF capitalism? Oh, all right. Remember, capitalism is the social and economic system that recognizes human rights and bans force from interaction. You need a government, right? This is not anarchism. This is not anarcho-capitalism, which is oxymoronic, right? This is capitalism. You need a government to remove force from the marketplace. But the IMF is supported by taxes, right? This is seized money. The IMF is a government-funded, government-run institution. This is not private property in the marketplace being exchanged freely, right? Now, if you don't think taxes are a violent seizure of money, try not paying them. Try not paying your taxes, right? I'm not necessarily going to get into the whole taxation is theft or taxation is immoral or anything like that here. But leave that argument aside for a second. You cannot dispute that taxation is a violent seizure of money, because if you do not freely give over your taxes, whether you consider it morally justified or not, if somebody doesn't give over their taxes, they will be locked in a human cage, right? So, and that's what's supporting the IMF here. Next point, the IMF was created because, according to them, international private capital markets were not functioning correctly. The IMF was created to allow governments to avoid the consequences of their own behavior so that they could skirt the markets, so that they could avoid being responsible for their own bad decisions. And the markets were saying things like, ooh, that's going to be really expensive and hard for you to do that, Paraguay, to borrow that much money, because, you know, you're not really managing it very well at all. And yes, your domestic economy is in the crapper, but it's going to be tough for you to get a flow of capital into your country because you're bad. No, when the markets were saying it, the IMF was created to jump in and help them and subsidize those poor government decisions, subsidize that and protect governments from the consequences of what they are doing. That's what the IMF was there for. This is statism, not capitalism. To call it capitalism on this test is so bad. So bad. You know, and this is government interference in the market. This is the complete opposite of capitalism. All right, so that's it. You know, that's the end of the multiple choice questions on this test. To be fair, the next question is about John Locke. It's a short answer question, but it's paired with the 1805 Haitian Constitution. So they're putting John Locke's second treatise on the same footing as the Haiti Constitution of 1805. Yeah, so, you know, we're done here. I made my point. I did not cherry pick these at all. I just went through the most recent New York State exam for global history and the first 30 multiple choice questions, or 29 or however many they had on there, and they're all just completely one-sided. Nothing about the benefits of capitalism, nothing about how The world is an infinitely better place now with Enlightenment values than it was 200 years ago, 100 years ago, even certainly 300, 400 years ago. Nothing about that, not even a hint or a whiff that the one-sidedness of this exam might be controversial at all, that some people with good minds and good hearts and good wills would object to what's being done on this exam. Not even a hint for our kids about that. I will mention that the default national curriculum, which is the advanced placement curriculum, that is more neutral than all the state curricula, and it is more neutral certainly than what the teachers are presenting in the classrooms. The AP actually has intelligent test writers. They understand more than just what they've been spoon-fed by their college professors. But which one is more impactful? Certainly the state curricula, certainly the individual classroom teachers. Your kids aren't being taught by AP writers. They're being taught by the state writers. And there is some overlap there, yes, but there is actually much more overlap between the classroom and state writers. I don't know anybody, for example, and of course this is just anecdotal, but this holds, I think, and my story is I personally don't know anybody who's written questions for the AP. I do know some graders. That's easy. But I do know two people who've written state questions. There's much more overlap between classroom teachers like me and state test writers than there is between classroom teachers like me and AP writers. All right, I did promise you a trucker quiz. We'll try to drag ourselves out of the depression that is the New York State Global History Exam here. It's 10-4, good buddy. Let's see. So first, your first fluency test here, E. Paul Torrance creativity test. You have to be fluent in every subject. You will have 10 seconds to think of your examples, your specific concrete examples within this topic. Ready? Go. Your topic is brands of trucks, brands of semi-trucks. Go. You got 10 seconds. That's about 5 seconds left. You can do it. How many different brands can you name? All right. Your time is up. You could have said Scania, Packer, which includes Peter Bolt and Kenworth and DAF. Could have said MAN or Volkswagen, Iveco, Volvo. The number 4 international truck manufacturer is International, as in International Harvester. Chug-a-lug-a-lug at 5 miles an hour. I'm an International Harvester. Great song. That's number 4 truck maker in the world. Number 3, Dongfeng. Then you have Tata in India. And the world number 1 by a mile, by a lot, is Daimler, which includes Mercedes-Benz, Freightliner, Mitsubishi Fuso. A lot of different brands under Daimler. And I believe that they are number 1 by almost 50% above their nearest competitor. They're way out in front in terms of manufacturing trucks. All right, so hopefully you did well on that. Now let's try another approach to fluency here. How many different examples, specific concrete examples, can you get within the truck category? I will give you a truck, and you tell me the trucker, or I will give you a clue, I should say. And you tell me the trucker. Here we go. Number 1, the leader of the convoy. Yes, it's the rubber duck. The rubber duck from that great song, Convoy, in the 70s during the trucker craze in America. And, of course, played by Kris Kristofferson in the movie. Number 2, your clue is the orangutan. Yes, his name is Clyde. And Philo, played by Clint Eastwood, is the trucker. Number 3, the chimpanzee, named after a football coach. Yes, a blatant ripoff of Clyde and Clint Eastwood's Every Which Way But Loose. This one was the TV series BJ and the Bear. The chimpanzee was named after Bear Bryant. Greg Evigan played BJ the trucker. Pretty darn good capitalist movie, by the way. Our capitalist TV series in the 3rd season of BJ and the Bear, right? The BJ has been persecuted mercilessly by this state regulatory agency, who the director of which also owns a trucking company, and he's, you know, rent seeking and using the power of the government to try to put BJ out of business. So of course, what does BJ have to do? He can't hire any regular truckers, so he hires like seven gorgeous women to be his truck drivers. It's interesting. But yeah, just a blatant ripoff of Every Which Way But Loose. Number four. Oh, I really hope you get this. Number four, the clue is you can't catch me on the grade. Do you know that? You can't catch me on the grade. Ha! Dennis Weaver said that. This is from the movie Duel, right? Dennis Weaver, a motorist in a car, and the villain is a nameless, faceless truck driver. This movie, The Duel, is, or just Duel, is notable, right? Because it was Steven Spielberg's first feature film. It wasn't in the theaters. I think it was an ABC Movie of the Week. But Steven Spielberg's first feature film from a story by Richard Matheson, who also wrote I Am Legend. And if you've only seen the movie versions of I Am Legend or Charlton Heston's The Omega Man, you need to go read the story so that you can actually figure out why the title is I Am Legend. It's far cooler than in any of the movie versions. I never have understood why the movie, well, I think I know why. It's an us versus them thing, but I think it would be much better if they followed Richard Matheson's short story for those I Am Legend movies. All right. Truckers, finally. So for number four, clue, you can't catch me on the grade. That was the faceless villain, the trucker, the nameless villain, the trucker in Duel. Steven Spielberg's first feature film. And finally, five, your last clue, the Dalton Highway. Yes, those are the Ice Road Truckers from the History Channel's long-running, 11-year running series, Ice Road Truckers up there in Alaska, going across frozen lakes, etc. Fantastic show. Trucker culture had a moment in the sun in 1970s in America. My family had a CB. It was an interesting time. Interesting time. Okay, folks. I will see you tomorrow, and I hope you have an absolutely fantastic day. Take care.